Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. This is the virtual Dr. Dawn speaking. This week, I'm off at the Institute for Functional Medicine conference, my annual pilgrimage to the halls of functional medicine. I expect to be bringing you lots of interesting science tidbits on non-pharmacological treatment of various diseases and the biochemistry behind them over the next several months. But today, I thought we would talk about the elephant in the room. Now, if you're in an alcoholic family, the elephant in the room is the alcoholism. If you're in a dysfunctional nation, well, in this case, the elephant in the room is, why do we need health insurance companies anyway? Yes, we're going to talk about single payer today. I want to start off by just pointing out that the reason that we're in the situation we're in is a historical accident. And there's nothing really honorable or venerable about a historical accident, and you don't have to persist in the perpetuation of a historical accident. You can instead take a deep breath and say, we seem to have taken the wrong path. Let's backtrack and take a better one. Well, would that it were so simple as that. Vested interests and the virtual corporate ownership of the democratic process in this country makes that a very difficult proposition. As our speaker today will discuss, it pretty much means that you and I all have to take to the street, waving hose and picket signs and probably farming implements to get the attention of Congress. Well, maybe it won't quite come to waving farming implements in the air. To kick off today's program, I have a couple of emails. One of them is from Dr. Morris in Paso Robles, California. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I listen to your program on a regular basis and like the way you deal with current topics. I am a retired anesthesiologist who trained in the United Kingdom and worked in the National Health Service for a number of years. Everyone who lives in the UK is covered by the government that runs the National Health Service. The main problem is the way the system is set up means that there are long waiting lists for treatment of elective cases. One of the main reasons for this is that the doctors working in the system are on fixed salaries and have no incentives to deal with more than a minimum number of patients, since they would not be paid any more if they saw increased numbers, hence the long waiting lists. In this country, however, healthcare coverage is woefully inadequate, a system brought about by the private insurance companies. They seem to be in the business of not insuring the population who really need healthcare, and it seems that for those who get insured, they spend enormous efforts to deny any claims that they get. The bottom line is profit for the shareholders and the CEOs who are paid outrageous salaries. They will never tell you how much of the premiums they take in actually go towards treating patients, but I'm sure that billions of dollars get diverted into profits and not into healthcare. The only way to avoid this egregious situation is to do away with all the current private insurance companies and have a single-payer system as they have in the UK, but more incentive-based so that the medical profession is encouraged to see and treat patients in a timely fashion, and everyone living in this country would be covered. As long as these private companies are allowed to exist, then the current system will prevail, and a large chunk of the premiums that we pay will end up not in providing health care, but increasing the profit margins of these predatory companies. Keep up the good work. Hugh Morris, MD. And this email, resonating like crazy with the last one, from Michelle in New Zealand. Hi there. I just discovered the podcast and find it so interesting. It is very informative on health issues, but also as a snapshot of a healthcare system. I still, every time I hear about the healthcare system in your country, find it seriously disturbing, and it also makes me appreciate ours. Although New Zealand does struggle with the usual issues, such as too many patients, not enough money, and doctors, etc., I personally know that if I break my leg or get cancer, I will get treated well, and I will get it free. I cannot believe that a country as wealthy as yours has children and poor people who are not being treated for life-threatening conditions. It is truly crazy. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you, Hugh, and thank you, Michelle, for a beautiful lead-in to this week's discussion, a conversation about single payer.
Today, we will be speaking with Lorna Grundemann, who is a critical care nurse with 21 years experience here at our local Dominican hospital. She's also a board member on the National Nurses Organizing Committee of the California Nursing Association. And we're here to talk about single payer. Lorna, thank you very much for coming and welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
During the last election, it seemed as if single payer was on the table. And now that we've elected Obama, that would seem to be the guest who isn't invited to dinner. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what single payer means and try to define that term a little bit, because there are various versions of single payer. And so please clarify for us what single payer means to your organization and what form of it you're advocating for.
Okay, well, there are various plans out there right now, and I think that makes the situation more confusing. Some people refer to universal health care, which would not necessarily be a single-payer system of health care. So the California Nurses Association basically looks at it as there are two plans out there. There's single-payer, and there's everything else that everybody has been talking about and suggesting in these forums and Senate committees. Single-payer is what we advocate, and we think that that's the only way this country is going to be able to receive health care for all. And that involves a single payer, which would be a government entity that would be set up by law through bills. There are actually two bills out there right now, one in the California legislature called Senate Bill 810, and the other one is in the federal house, is where it resides right now, and that's H.R. 676. Both of those bills, they're very similar, would set up a national payer system. So, for instance, if I were sick or needed to see a doctor, I would have a national healthcare card. I could choose whichever doctor, whichever hospital, whichever clinic or alternative type of medicine I would like. And that bill, when I went to see the provider, would be submitted to the single payer, which would be this government entity. And there would be oversight and it would be transparent according to the bills that are out there right now. That's what they would be advocating.
The characteristics that all of the single-payer plans that are on the table, whether it's Kucinich's Medicare for All, which was a nice, simple, soundbite kind of description of what it would look like, to other proposals which have been to expand the plan that the federal employees currently have and make that a universal plan, all share a common opposition from the powers that be, from the entities, particularly the insurance companies, that obviously would have to go away pretty much entirely under most single-payer plans. There would be no place for them.
Right. That's what single-payer would mean. It would mean that the insurance companies would no longer exist as they do today. Right now, I'm sure you're dealing a lot with insurance companies in your business. And the way we operate today, the insurance companies actually take about a third of every dollar to maintain their businesses, for the overhead, the doctors having to submit bills and all of the time and money associated with that, to pay the executives of insurance companies. All of those types of costs take about a third of every dollar of healthcare coverage in our country. That could be put toward actually caring for people. And that's what the single payer system would do. It would eliminate that kind of cost.
Well, 2 points about that. One of which is, I think that the third is actually an underestimate of the amount of waste in the system, because it doesn't account for my overhead. Mm-hmm. And when I've done calculations as a businesswoman about what percentage of my overhead is dedicated towards chasing reimbursement for services that I've already provided from the various insurance companies, it works out to 15 to 20% of additional cost, and that's modest. It can be much higher than that with some health plans. It's easily 50% of what I charge goes away as overhead immediately, trying to collect what I've just charged. That can be very, very huge for laboratory entities, for hospitals. The cost of actually collecting your income is not even counted in that 30%. One of the fears, I think that, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, but that hidden cost in the system is a huge hit on productivity and also effectiveness that I think isn't even being accounted for because no one really has a way to tease that number out, so they just pretend it's not there. But it has to be another 5 to 10% of the healthcare dollar, modestly, that's being the sound of, you know, many toilets flushing in many medical offices all over the country goes away. And, you know, from my standpoint, that would be nice.
Yes.
And would help offset some of what would undoubtedly be lower fees under a single payer system. I want to emphasize some general positives about what Obama is proposing and the general principles there, and talk about how we can make sure that what happens in the next cycle of decision making, which will probably occur within the next year or two, although implementation is probably in the teens. In that next cycle of decision making, I believe that there may be things that we could build upon to move to a single payer. Let me just stop and ask you, maybe that's a false premise. Do you believe that in the current political environment, with the current financial issues and the current power structures as they exist, that a single payer plan could pass Congress and be enacted into law in the next 2 years?
Well, I think in order for that to happen, it would have to be an uprising, a grassroots level uprising. I mean, at this point, there are several groups, many groups of people, I think, across this country who are working toward that. There's the Physicians for National Health Plan. There's the Progressive Democrats of America. There's school employees. There's, of course, NNOC-CNA. And we're trying to push this grassroots movement to happen. We were in Washington last week. There was a big rally held. We were part of the demonstration that was held at Senator Baucus's Finance Committee meeting. We held a silent protest. Several people, nurses and doctors, were arrested. And there will be ongoing court battles about that as well, trying to just push this agenda that we desperately need a single-payer system in this country. The reality of it happening, you know, I have to say, a little less positive about that within the next 2 years. I think that there are, you know, the forces against it are huge. There's the entire, of course, healthcare industry, insurance companies are against it, and the pharmaceutical companies are against it. And I don't know how many of your listeners may have seen Sicko, but I think Michael Moore gave a great examples of how deep into the pockets our representatives are, into the insurance pockets. And so they have forces pushing against them that we're going to have to really create another force pushing back. So I think at this point, we're looking at probably our best options being the public option, which people have been talking about, is possibly another way to get at single payer, or states beginning to institute the single payer system like California, Maine, Colorado. I think there's about a dozen states now that are looking at trying to pass bills within the state systems for single payer. And then if those states actually make a go of it with their single payer systems, then I think it will become pretty much a mandate across the country.
In my view, probably the strongest argument in favor of single payer is costs. One of Obama's chief goals, he calls them the bedrock requirements for healthcare reform. This is coming off of his current website. Any plan for healthcare reform must reduce costs, guarantee choice, and ensure quality care for all. So let's take those three goals. Let's examine the contrast between that and what everyone has agreed is what's on the table politically. And let me just stop for a moment and comment that what's on the table politically now is almost identical, with a few exceptions, to what was proposed by the Clinton administration in 1993. And at that time, was viewed as a radical, radical thing. And the objections to Clinton's radical 1993 proposal, among other things, were that people would lose choice, that they would not be able to see any doctor they chose to, that their benefits would be restricted and that their health care was rationed. Now, ironically, in the 16 years since then, people have lost the ability to see whatever doctor they want. They've ended up paying a much larger financial share of their health care, which is a form of rationing. Mm-hmm. And all of the bugbears that were presented as the result of healthcare reform in 1993 are actually now being presented as reasons why we need healthcare reform.
Right.
I find that very ironic.
Yes, it is.
The idea that is currently on the table, that finally, faced with the prospect of single payer or worse, has brought the AMA and the insurance corporation body, I don't know what they're called, but the trade organization for the health insurance.
AHRP,
You know, the trade organization for the doctors, the trade organization for the hospitals, the trade organization for the large employers, the trade organization for the insurance companies, all of whom are important stakeholders, are there at the table having nice civil conversations and making sure they bar the door against single payer. So in a way, single payer has actually been extremely useful as a specter of having to deal with this. It's actually gotten them talking.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what they're doing now is horse trading. So the insurance industry recently announced that they're going to reduce the rate of increase of healthcare costs by 1.5%. And oh, won't that save a lot of money? Of course, what they probably want as the quid pro quo for this, you know, marvelous concession. Is the sarcasm dripping heavily enough from my words to come across on the radio?
It's good for me, yeah.
this miraculous concession is going to cost us elimination of the public option. And I, as well as I think most people, view a public option as a necessity, because otherwise this is a great big tarp for health insurance. Mm-hmm. It's health insurance companies have endangered assets in that they might actually have to pay for health care. So as a result, we're going to make sure that we create a mandate, which was, by the way, explicitly one of the things that Obama said he would not support during his campaign, although I thought that was a foolish thing to say at the time, and clearly it was. A mandate is a necessity. Okay, we all agree to that. But if there's a mandate and there's no public option, then that mandate represents a great big Christmas present to the insurance industry, and no one's really talking about that. In my view, the public option has to remain on the table. And perhaps that would at least give us, for those many millions of people who are uninsured, give them some way to get some kind of health care coverage. That would be a social good, and I would be happy to see it happen. But I want to point out that in terms of containing costs, this has absolutely no potential, as it is currently framed, to do what the Obama website says is one of the three prongs.
Mm-hmm.
What's currently on the table cannot, by definition, reduce costs. It will, in fact, increase costs because it'll pay for more care for more people who are currently doing without.
Yes.
Guarantee choice. Well, that probably will do in the sense that you will have the choice of the government panel or the choice of the Blue Cross panel or the choice of the Blue Shield panel. But in terms of ensuring that all doctors and all providers are available, it will not do that, because all doctors and all providers will not sign up for the lower paid panels.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest that what this program will do is be a shot in the arm to the concierge movement, mm-hmm. because the best doctors and the doctors who are the most in demand, best being, of course, a relative term, but the doctors who have more commercial, for whatever reason, more commercial leverage, will tend to move into a concierge system under this plan in order to maximize their income.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. That's an interesting thought.
Because demand is going to go up and supply is fixed.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that the three precepts he has there would be met by single payer.
That's where I expect you to step in and explain why single payer is superior on each of these three. I've outlined the drawbacks in the first two, the reduced costs and the guaranteed choice. In terms of ensuring quality for all, let me just say that there's nothing about the plan that's currently on the table that ensures quality for all. It relies on the market, and the market is going for the bottom line. So ensuring high quality health care, there's nothing about what's currently being discussed by the great powers that would do that.
Right.
And of course, that's one of the things that single payer could do very effectively. So now on the reduced costs, Lorna, you're on.
Well, recently, the research arm of CNA, NNOC, did a study. It was a ripple study, which, according to what I understand, means you, it's like you drop a pebble in a pond and you watch the ripples come out, and that's what this study did. Drop the pebble of single payer in the pond and watched what happened as a result of that in all the economic ways that this study could look at. And what they actually came up with was that it would create 2.6 million jobs in the country.
Do you know how many people are currently employed by the health insurance sector?
I don't know that number.
Okay. Yeah. Because I suspect it's higher than 2.6 million, to be fair.
It could be.
To be fair, I think there'll be a net loss of jobs in the insurance paper-pushing sector.
Right. I'm sure there will be. And in both of the bills that are on the table now, state and federal, there are programs for retraining people that would lose their jobs as a result of single payer. It would also, this ripple study showed that it would also increase business and public revenues by $317 billion, and that we would have $44 billion in new tax revenues.
From that $317 billion?
Yes. Beyond that, the single-payer system is a system that would cost less, ultimately. It would be something that would provide health care for everyone in the country. Right now, what I see happening as a nurse at Dominican is people wait to come in. People are waiting longer and they get sicker, and I'm in critical care and they end up in my unit. And when you're in my unit, it costs thousands of dollars a day for your care. And I've seen people there many times that could have been taken care of earlier in their disease process and not ended up in our unit. So there is preventative care written into single payer, because everybody would have health care. It would be easy to come see you as a doctor and get my sinus infection taken care of before it became, you know, something that needed surgery on my brain or something like that, you know. So I think the single payer is definitely the way to go if you're going to talk about saving dollars, saving money.
I think that beyond saving dollars, there's also the costs that are not immediately attributable or don't accrue to the balance sheet of healthcare, but accrue to the balance sheet of society. We know, for example, that when children receive proper health care and early interventions for their developmental disorders or other illnesses, that they are healthier, more productive, and are less likely to be on the welfare rolls for the rest of their life because they sustained brain damage from an unidentified case of meningitis because they couldn't get in to have that meningitis diagnosed promptly. That sort of cost, that goes to the social welfare budget. It's never really considered as it leaves the system.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is lost work productivity for people. Again, that accrues to a different balance sheet. And yet we are in a closed cycle here. Our economy is a closed cycle, although we do our accounting as if it were a series of open systems where the inputs of one didn't represent the outputs of another.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
And that's just kind of a blinders about the way we do it. When you look at the emotional costs also, and just the costs in terms of justice,
yes, exactly.
There's no question that everyone needs access and good access, prompt access. And anything that interferes with your ability to get in, we should be looking at that as a project. How do we eliminate it? Under our current system, there are a lot of barriers to receiving care, even if you have insurance nominally.
Right. One other thing I wanted to mention about this study was that currently our system, our healthcare system overall, costs, I believe it was $2.1 trillion a year. And this study shows that if you wanted to cover everybody in the country under a single-payer system, it would cost $63 billion more. And if you compare that to what we have already spent to bail out Citigroup, Fannie Mae, the TARP program, AIG, it would be what you would consider a drop in the bucket, because those programs have cost us trillions of dollars already. So $63 billion more is what it would cost us to insure everyone in the country and have a healthier citizenry because of that.
As we talk about single payer, obviously there's a great deal of details to be hammered out, and we'll be looking at models of successful single payer systems that currently exist. Can you speak to the topic of what other countries have successful single-payer systems, and what, just in broad strokes, the common characteristics of successful single-payer systems seem to be?
Well, every other industrialized country in the world has some form of a single-payer system, universal health coverage for their citizens. They look different in different countries. England, for instance, has a national healthcare system that is actually run by the government. So the doctors, hospitals, nurses are all paid by the government. That's not what we're looking at with our single-payer system here in America. We're looking at, as I said before, a government agency that pays the bills, but the doctors and hospitals and other clinics and things of that sort are still independently run businesses. So that would be the difference between a national healthcare system such as England has and our single-payer idea. We would be more like Canada or France, I believe, where they have healthcare for everyone. It is paid through a single government entity, but everybody has the freedom to go see whichever provider they want to see. So that's what we're talking about in the United States. I think one of the countries that has recently gone to a system like that and has found it successful is Taiwan. I think that's the latest example of that actually working well in a modern country. And I believe they had to make the switch, like we would have to do, from having a free market system running their healthcare system to having more of a government-run healthcare system. And that's one of the things that Obama, you know, when he was campaigning, and recently in New Mexico, he said, you know, if we were starting from scratch, he thinks a single-payer system would be the place to start, would work, but we're not starting from scratch. And I think that that's what we need to push Obama on, is that it doesn't matter that we're not starting from scratch. Things are pretty much falling apart at this point in our system, and we need to do something. We're desperate to do something at this point to give everyone health care.
Well, I think that the statement that Obama made was more a statement about political necessity. Mm-hmm. I think he was saying this single payer is more desirable, but it's a political impossibility based on the political forces that are arrayed against it. So let's take a moment and talk about that. First of all, the reason that there is enormous opposition is because there are a number of entities that see a loss of income, sometimes a substantial or even a total loss of their business, were we to switch to a single payer, and they are naturally not in favor of committing suicide or falling upon their sword. And of course, the chief one of these would be the insurance entities, but we also have to add to that workman's compensation. And to a large extent, there is, I think, a strong reason for the tort lawyers of America mm-hmm. to be against this. And that has to do with standards. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Okay. The idea that healthcare should be for profit for the investors is kind of an odd thing that was just introduced back in about 1988 to this country. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, a hospital could be a for-profit hospital, but insurance companies were not-for-profit by definition, and were not able to be publicly held corporations until the Reagan era. And it was at the time that it became a source for stock market profit that we started to see the large siphoning of resources to overhead. Previously, all of the payments had to be reinvested back into the system, and so the overhead was quite a bit lower because you weren't draining off money. At the point that it became corporate, we saw a consolidation of health plans and an attempt to develop a large market share such that they had negotiating power to drive prices down. In the initial phases of that, prices did drop, and hospitals and doctors' fees declined, not just the rate of increase declined, but they actually declined, went negative relative to rate of inflation and everything else. That could only be sustained for so long. It led to redundancies being squeezed out of the system, but it also led to some closures and a great deal of industry consolidation on the part of the healthcare industries and doctors' groups, which achieved an easy kind of balance with the insurance companies. So now doctors have banded together into large entities to have bargaining power. And the most effective doctor's practice is not Marcus Welby and his partner in a small little building in some neighborhood. It's a large downtown building with a medical multi-specialty mm-hmm. group. And multi-specialty groups are the only one who can capture enough of the local market to be able to defend themselves against the price-lowering practices of the insurance companies, who hold a semi-monopoly
and can take away a third of your business. If they can take away a third of my business, they can drive me out of business. And if I am part of a larger entity, then they can't do that because they still have to provide health care for that community because they have a contract. So we have this uneasy truce right now. All of that structure, all of the people who work for the doctors groups and large multi-specialty groups, administrative staffs, all of that necessity goes away. So there are a great many people who have reason to oppose this, who don't work for an insurance company. They may work for a county medical society or a nonprofit doctor's group. But for them, single payer is still a disaster because they would lose their jobs. And I think the last piece of the opposition, and this is the most exploitable group, are the people who have quote-unquote good health insurance. And while it's a declining group, it's people who think they have good health insurance probably represent close to a majority, although it's probably close to a tie. They're still okay, and in any new rewrite of the plan, they're concerned about losing benefits. And people vote their self-interest, and they encourage their legislatures to vote their self-interest. This group is also the most easily exploited because they can be manipulated by advertising campaigns. I understand that Blue Cross just put a lot of money into an advertising campaign to try to eliminate the government option. And why is it, do you think, that they're also afraid about the public option?
I think that they see it as competition and a way to possibly get to single payer and a way to eliminate some of what they're making their money on. I'm worried about the public option from another point of view. The insurance companies tend to cherry pick. I mean, they pick the healthiest patients. And so there is some concern that with the public option, the sickest patients would end up in the public plan. And then in that way, bankrupt the public plan eventually, with the healthiest people being insured by the insurance companies. And that's what they do now. I mean, right. They keep the healthiest people and kick the sick people out.
So how can the insurance companies simultaneously be worried about losing patients to the public plan and the lawmakers be worried about adverse selection into the public plan? How can both of these fears take place at the same time? They seem internally contradictory.
Yes, they do. And I'm not clear on that either. I just know that Massachusetts is an example. They have a plan that includes a public option. Everybody's mandated to have insurance in that state. That state is not doing well with their health plan at this point. It's costing much more than they thought it would. People that they thought would sign up are not signing up because they'd rather take the penalty, which is, they get taxed essentially for not having health care. But that costs less than having a health plan because the health plans that they're offering cost people, a family of four, let's say $12,000 a year deductible. Mm-hmm. You're never going to get to use your health insurance at that point.
It's just
you're going to be paying out of pocket. It's just a cost to you, right? So people aren't signing up for it. So the public plan, I'm not clear on how both of those fears exist at the same time. I know that CNA's fear with that is just what I stated, that you'll end up with the sick patients in the public plan and then bankrupt the public plan eventually. And that seems to be, to some degree, these fears of mandated health care and public plans are being borne out in states like Massachusetts and other states where they've tried the same kind of plan in Massachusetts and has failed in the past. Oregon was one of those states, and there are several other states where the mandated health insurance has not worked. So what do you think? I mean, why do you think those two fears exist simultaneously?
Well, I think it's a debating point. I don't think that either of these fears makes sense because it's not looking at things as the complex dynamic that it would be. In terms of health care for all under the Obama administration, the government plan would be well funded and probably represent a bargain, a savings. And so there would be, I expect, migration of people who could choose a more expensive plan with equivalent benefits that would be offered by one of the private players. Essentially, it would drive down corporate profits. So from the standpoint of corporation, insurance corporation, it's a bad thing. What I'm more worried about is what happens to that plan when it starts to look like Medicaid. In other words, under a conservative Republican administration, for example, I would expect the public plan not to be well funded. And so I would expect that what will happen is what happens with Medicaid is that services and breadth of services start to be decreased. And if you keep the mandate that everyone has to be covered, then what that means is they are covered, but they are covered for less and less and less. And you end up with the incredible shrinking health plan.
Right.
And this is kind of a backwards argument. One of the best arguments in favor of single payer is exactly the arguments made by the insurance industries against the public option. Yes, you're right. And yes, you're right. And really, the conclusion is we should do away with you, because then there is no false market competition. There's no profit taking. There's no just money being spent for advertising. I mean, the advertising budget alone for the health plans would probably cover a couple million people in terms of free money that is out there on the table being spent. So there's another group that probably opposes single payer, because they're going to lose a very lucrative contract, which is the advertising contracts.
I agree. There are many groups, powerful groups, that see their income going away if single payer passes. The other side of that is that there are many Americans who are losing their health care coverage because they're losing their jobs, or they're inadequately covered in their health care plans now, and may or may not know that depending on what they've had to use of that coverage and what care they've actually been able to get. And as I think, as we see more and more people being affected by this, that is the grassroots movement that has to come to fruition. And I think that we're beginning to see that happen. I know that just in my family alone, my son will be graduated from college. He'll have no health coverage unless he finds a job. And this is a very poor job market. He's a philosophy major. I mean, you know, there's probably not going to be a lot of jobs out there for him.
Well, there won't be a lot of jobs with health insurance.
That's what I mean. Exactly. Yeah, he may find a job, you know, at a bookstore or something, but he probably will not have health insurance. My daughter's also a student. Her husband just lost his job 6 months ago. They have no health insurance. My granddaughter, fortunately, is now on the Healthy Families Plan. So, but then that's another, you know, entity, a government sort of entity that exists and is successful, I assume, for children to be taken care of. What I'm saying is it's a good example of how we can take care of people in an agency like that that's run as a government, in a government situation.
Healthy Families is, I think, a good place to look rather than Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
For a model of what a single payer plan might look like, in terms of it does behave pretty much like an insurance agency, and it has a benefit structure, and that's that. There's a lot of people who are feeling disturbed and threatened. That's true. But psychologically, when people are disturbed and threatened, the normal reaction is to freeze and hunker down, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So what does the single payer movement, I guess it's fair to call it a movement, how does it plan on mobilizing this fear, overcoming the natural deer in the headlights kind of emotional reaction that so many people will have? And even if you mobilize people, what are you supposed to do with them? Are you going to have them march down Market Street in San Francisco carrying signs? Are you going to have them write a letter to their congressperson? I mean, what are the mechanisms for mobilization that you figure will be effective? And we really have an enormous array of forces against you. What's the plan for overcoming that? You said grassroots movement, but elaborate on that.
Well, good questions. Yeah. Well, I think all of what you said are part of it. Definitely, you know, writing letters to your congresspeople, writing letters to the editor, using your own personal examples if you have them. There are websites now. If you go onto the California Nurses website, it's calnurses.org, calnurses.org. There's a section called Guaranteed Healthcare where people are writing their stories. And there's another section that's called Single Payer. You'll find these links on the website where people are blogging with each other about what's going on in their own personal lives with their health insurance. But yes, what does a grass movement look like? And I think that's tough. You know, I think it's hard right now to get, I think, our hands around that. But what part of what we're doing is mobilizing the nurses around the country. And we're doing that by forming a national nurses union. And there are 2.1 million nurses in the United States. So we're the largest workforce in the country. And I think that that's a lot of the way that CNA and NOC plans to mobilize this grassroots movement is through nurses working in hospitals every day with patients and bringing those forces to bear on our representatives. And you're right, it's going to take a lot of power. I mean, I personally think it will probably take people in the streets. I mean, it's going to take people demonstrating, going to Washington in mass numbers to have any kind of effect against these very wealthy corporations that are now running our system.
I don't think anybody is running the system, actually. I think you've got a lot of people yanking on the steering wheel in various directions. But people are certainly not running things. And yet, I also don't think the corporations are running things. Everyone feels a little bit helpless. The corporations feel at the mercy of Washington. Washington feels at the mercy of the campaign funding provided by this. I feel at the mercy of my legislature in terms of his possibilities for reelection. First and foremost, I want to keep people with good progressive values in office, so I don't want to push them to take positions that will get them kicked out of office the next time there's a campaign. And that moderating influences, such as it is the closest thing, I guess, we've got to a boil it all down democracy. Mm-hmm. But how you build a healthcare system out of that that is in any way, shape, or form rational is beyond me. Let's talk towards the end about the basic values and some of the challenges that the concept of single payer presents, because I do think that I have some questions about what it would look like. I don't expect you to answer them, but they're interesting thought problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One of them is, when we talk about having access to healthcare, that is generally thought to mean having some sort of financial reimbursement so that they can go to a doctor's office or get that CT scan or whatever is appropriate for their healthcare needs. And when we talk about access, that is only really a small part of true access, because as a distributive justice, as a distributive good, if I lived in northeastern California and I needed an MRI scan, I might have to drive or fly to the nearest MRI center. And certainly under any kind of rational consolidation, you might have two or three MRIs in a state the size of Oregon. They're really, you don't need 500. So what about people who are far away? Does healthcare for all mean that they also get reimbursement for the gasoline, for the motel room that they need? Is that just part of their choice, their cost for living off where they live? And if they choose not to receive care because it's too inconvenient, haven't we defeated some of the purpose of single payer, which is to keep costs down by getting people to be taken care of early?
Right.
So that's one.
Uh-huh.
A second one is the cost of new technology. Currently, what fuels acquisition of new technology is market and competition. And when a new technology comes along, the way our current system works, it all depends on Medicare. As far as adoption of new technology goes, once Medicare decides that they will pay for that new technology, then it starts to be widely distributed because you know you can count on the income from Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, if Medicare authorizes something, the health plans will fall into line. So you will get a loss of adoption of new technologies in places where the reimbursement is marginal. And it will definitely slow innovation. I think people who say that medical device manufacturing and medical innovation would be less rapid under single payer do have an argument. And then you run into the thing, but some medical innovation is very important and potentially quite cost effective. If we can do genetic testing, for example, and identify people who will develop diabetes or hypertension in their 30s and target those groups for early interventions, lifestyle interventions, which we know would work, then we could conceivably save a lot of money. This is just a hypothetical argument, mm-hmm. but it illustrates the point. But that would require the development of a sophisticated genetic technology, which isn't going to be funded by a market. So why would anyone invest the money, the research funding, the capital, to create a test that they can't be sure of selling? And right now, with the current chaotic system, you can sort of more of a bet that you'll be able to sell it than under single payer. Under single payer, things definitely slow down because any decision to adopt a new technology has huge cost implications.
Right.
And that would require a level of cost effectiveness study. It's sort of a catch-22. You can't do the cost effectiveness study and generate that data without large numbers. And you can't get the large numbers because no one's going to create the technology in order to provide it to people.
Mm-hmm.
So we open this huge can of worms.
Well, what did we do before the industry became profit-making and consolidated? And before 1988, there were innovations before that time when it became such a money-making machine.
I think the pace of innovation in medical care was slower before the mid-1980s. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of my own gestalt, I'd started medical school in 1982, so I really can't say for a fact that it was slower, but it seems to me that and a lot of the innovations are useless and are superseded in a few mm-hmm. years or never should have been adopted right. in the first place. So there's a lot of noise. I think that most of it came from federal funding, NIH grants, and university funding. What happened in the 80s was that it became corporatized.
Right.
And so the patents, being able to take out a patent on something, led to these private think tanks being developed, and the whole biotech industry really took off from there.
And now we have the corporations coming into the universities and influencing whatever innovation might be going on there.
Yes, and every now and then a university professor comes up with something that he can turn into a business and becomes a millionaire.
Right.
And that has, I'm sure, motivated some people to go into scientific research, but only people who were extremely foolish and didn't understand probability. For the most part, you go into science because you love it.
Yes.
And you want to make a difference. And that hasn't changed. But if the government funding wasn't reinstated, there would definitely be a slowing of innovation. And I am merely playing devil's advocate mm-hmm. here and throwing out right. these issues to illustrate that as we talk about single payer, we're talking about a whole new can of worms.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of worms in that can.
Right.
And life will not be simple afterwards. And I expect to be complaining and whining and moaning to my colleagues in the surgeon's lounge just as loudly under a single payer plan as I do now. It'll be a different set of worms.
Exactly. It's not a panacea. We're not going to solve all problems. But when you're talking about the morality, the social justice issue that's involved in this, I think that's the bottom line. I mean, we can talk about the finances.
It's not the bottom line, but it's the strongest argument.
Yes. Humanity is, yes, to be human is what a single-payer system is really about. And fortunately, from our perspective, CNA and NOC's perspective, the finances work out too. I know you're bringing up a lot of problems, and I'm sure there will be problems along the way. But everybody does need some form of health care in this country. We're the wealthiest country in the world. And it's only right, when you look at it from a justice perspective, that everybody receive health care. At least the bottom line, get your immunizations and get your sore throat checked. And, you know, we all need to at least start there. And at this point, we all know that's not where people are. There are people, 50 million Americans without health care, almost the same number of Americans that are underinsured. 100 million Americans, my God. How long can this go on? It's not even a sustainable system at that point. I mean, if you keep kicking people out of insurance companies because they're not healthy enough, and then there's all this, how long could that go on? I don't think that insurance, if they continue to do that, is even a sustainable business, really, forever.
Not without that mandate.
Yeah, that's right. I guess you're right. That's why they need that mandate. That's why they're fighting this so hard. So, yes, it's quite a can of worms.
When I was in residency, I lived in Scrubs. We all lived in Scrubs. At my residency program in San Bernardino, I had kind of a button culture. So everyone wore lots of buttons on their scrubs, little message buttons, sometimes sarcastic, sometimes political, often political. And I remember two buttons that I still have. I kept them in my little memory box, and I hope someday to be able to take them out and view them as superfluous, like an old campaign button on an election that's long ago passed. The two buttons are still relevant and could still be worn on my lapel. One of them says, healthcare for all by the year 2000, which is a nice joke.
Yeah.
But in 1988, that seemed like a very reasonable goal, healthcare for all by the year 2000. And the other one says healthcare is a right, not a privilege.
Right.
And someday, I hope, before I die, to be able to view those as last year's issue. Thank you very much for coming on the program. Lorna Grundemann, you've been wonderful, and I've enjoyed our conversation.
I have as well. Thank you.
You've been listening to Lorna Grundemann, a real person, a local critical care nurse and board member on the National Nurses Organizing Committee of the California Nursing Association.
Hello, it's the virtual Dr. Dawn, and I'm back with just a few emails and stories to round out this week's program. An interesting study, a follow-up on BPA, that is to say, bisphosphonyl A, and plastic water bottles. Researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health recruited Harvard College students for this study. The 77 participants began the study with a 7-day washout phase in which they drank all cold beverages from stainless steel bottles in order to minimize BPA exposure. Participants provided urine samples during the washout period. They were then given 2 polycarbonate bottles and asked to drink all cold beverages from these bottles during the next week. Urine samples were also provided during this time. The results showed that the participants' urinary BPA concentrations increased 69% after drinking from the polycarbonate bottles. The study authors noted that BPA concentrations in the college population were similar to those reported for the U.S. general population. Previous studies have shown that BPA could leach from polycarbonate bottles into their contents, but this is the first study to show a corresponding increase in urinary BPA in humans. One of the study's strengths, the authors note, is that the students drank from the bottles in a normal use setting. Additionally, the students did not wash their bottles in dishwashers nor put hot liquids in them. Heating has been shown to increase the leaching of BPA from polycarbonates, so the BPA levels might have been increased had the students drunk hot liquids from the bottles. This study comes at an important time when many states are deciding whether to ban the use of BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups. While the previous studies have demonstrated that BPA is linked to adverse health effects, this study fills in a missing piece of the puzzle, whether or not polycarbonate plastic bottles are an important contributor to the amount of BPA in the body. Looks like that advice that I gave you about 3 years ago, and you can check the website this week for the reference on that, was good advice. And I hope I'm always able to bring you good advice 3 or 4 years ahead of the event curve, just based on the basic science and a little rational extrapolation. Last week, I had a caller who asked me what nutrients she could take beyond calcium and vitamin D that might help her with osteoporosis. Well, I told her what I knew, but I didn't know this. A recent study shows that DHEA supplementation combined with vitamin D and calcium can significantly improve spinal bone density in older women. This study came from St. Louis University, and the chief investigator is Edward Weiss, W-E-I-S-S. The study looked at men and women aged 65 to 75 and divided them into 2 groups. The first received a DHEA supplement, vitamin D, and calcium for the 2 years. The control group received a placebo, vitamin D, and calcium in the first year, and then received the DHEA supplement in the second year in place of the placebo. The effects of the treatment differed for men and women. After the first year, women in the test group had an approximately 2% increase in bone density, while women in the control group did not see an increase. After the second year, when both groups took the DHEA supplement, women in the test group experienced an additional 2% increase for a total of approximately 4%, while women who switched from placebo to DHEA also experienced an approximately 2% increase. The same treatment, alas, did not offer similar benefits for older men. Instead, men in both the test and control groups experienced a 1 to 2% increase in spinal bone densities. These results suggest that vitamin D and calcium supplements could be responsible for the men's increase in bone density. DHEA is dehydroepiandrosterone, a naturally occurring steroid hormone produced in the adrenal glands, gonads, and brain. It decreases with age and has recently become a very popular supplement among the anti-aging set. I want to point out that the magnitude of the increase in bone density seen with DHEA, 2% per year, is equivalent or better than the increases seen with all of the current prescription drugs, including the Forteo that I discussed last week. In addition to its benefits to bone, DHEA has other benefits, including improvements in diabetes, heart disease, improvements in immune function, and improvements in psychological health. The dose of DHEA used in the study was 25%. We know that doses up to 50% per day are generally considered safe and effective. But because DHEA does increase estrogen and testosterone levels, people consuming it need to monitor their mammograms and their PSAs in case they have a pre-existing cancer that they could be stimulating with the growth hormone-like effects of estrogen and testosterone, respectively, on these cancers. We've come to the end of another hour of Ask Dr. Dawn. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn, the virtual Dr. Dawn, saying I'll be back next week. Until then, so long, and till we get this health insurance crisis fixed, you better stay healthy.